And thank you, sir. And your observations that you've made of ACAWSO.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Ken. So has this group seen, I know you sent the links, but like anybody not seen the management letter or the audited financials? Like if this is like brand new to anybody on the call? Because do I need to do like a walkthrough of those first before kind of doing a very brief discussion and then answer and then open it up kind of for questions? Like how do we want to do that?
The folks that I can see on the screen, they're all familiar with it, I would say.
Sounds good. Would it be helpful if I like shared my screen? It's basically just kind of, I'll start with the management comments because I know you just had the ACA internal document up. Would that be helpful if I shared my screen?
Brett, just a second. We've got a question from Kelly and a question from Josh. I know our questions are going to be afterwards, but if you have something you wanted to
Well,
make
if you have
sure
questions
we're
now,
staying on
shoot.
track now.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, I'm just not sure. I have seen it. Ken, you said we should all have seen it. I'm not sure. I mean, if it could be the audit, the actual audit, I don't think I've seen it.
Okay.
No,
Do we
there's
want to
a
start there possibly with the
what?
audit? Because there's two documents. It's the actual audit, which you'll see your financial statements, the note disclosures, my auditor opinion, and then the other one are recommendations on just how to be the best, nonprofit that you can be. So it's two separate PDFs. So yeah, if Kelly, if you haven't seen it, I'll start with one just to kind of whether it's a refresher for people or new for people, I think it's valuable to see that before answering any questions because if you haven't seen it before, the questions are going to be just a foreign language.
And Josh, is your question in the same way or is it something different?
I don't have a question. I have a comment. I think, Brett, it would be helpful to give the high level overview first, because while it has been posted, not everyone here has necessarily had a chance to look through it. I know I've looked through it and I have some comments, but I think a high level sort of flyover would be helpful before we dive into stuff personally.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and do that then. Is that okay, Ken?
Sure. Thank
And
you.
I know I recorded a video for, you, Ken, and then Sue, and then Bill and Sylvia. Does that get shared anywhere else? Or is that just for you, just for like the first? Now, this is a draft, right? That wasn't even like the final audit. So I'm assuming nobody on this call has seen that video link where I record and go through kind of what I'm doing here, but in much more detail that video compared to what I'm going to do now.
That is correct. That was an initial draft.
Yeah. Perfect. Okay, sound good. So I'm going to go ahead and see. I'm going to try sharing my screen. Let's see if there's any restrictions. I don't think there is. Everybody see it okay? Give me like a thumbs up, somebody kind of.
We can see it.
Hey, you're
Yeah,
good.
cool. Okay, so I'm going to start with just the audit itself. So first page, just title page. Now they are comparative financials. So last year they were not comparative because it was the first audit you've had in several years. So this compares your current year 2024 to 2023. So that's a significant change compared to last year. Next year is just the table of contents. So just my first my audit report and then the financial statements here and then the notes to the financials. These notes just describe the financials in more detail. So I'll walk through that real briefly. So these two first pages are my audit report. So this first section is my opinion section. And this basically says that the financial statements present fairly in all material respects, which is the best thing that you can have for an audit. It's also called an unqualified or unmodified opinion. So just kudos to the whole team for another one. So you had the same opinion last year for 2023. Now, how I get that opinion, this basis for opinion, is I have to conduct my audit in accordance with what's called GAAS, GAAS, Generally Accepted Auditing Standards in the United States of America. I'm also required to be independent of ACAWSO and to meet my other ethical responsibilities. And then I have to obtain audit evidence in order to provide a basis for my audit opinion, which have to be sufficient and appropriate for use. Next section is the responsibilities of management of the financials. So management is responsible for the preparation and fair presentation of the financials. They are also responsible for the design, implementation, and maintenance of internal control. And they have to evaluate whether there are any going concern issues as well. And then my auditor responsibilities, I have to obtain reasonable assurance on the financials in order to provide my opinion. And I do that through these five bullet points, which is to exercise my professional judgment and maintain professional skepticism. I have to identify and assess risks of material misstatement and then design my audit procedures to respond to those risks. I have to obtain an understanding of internal control, but I don't express an opinion on internal control. That's just to help me design my audit procedures. I evaluate accounting policies of the organization, significant accounting estimates made, and then I also do my own evaluation on any going concern issues. And then I also have other communications with governance, and that's exactly kind of what I'm doing here, where like the engagement letter that shows the plan, scope, and timing of my audit, any significant audit findings. So I had none this year. Ken touched on the one last year, which is the cost allocation, functional expense allocation that got resolved. And then the certain internal control related matters, which is more like the best practice management letter that'll also be going on the separate report here. So that's the audit report. This is, basically my report. The rest I assist with the financial statements, but these are your financial statements. So that's why this goes out in draft format, because management is responsible for the preparation and fair presentation of these. So first here is
Brett,
the what's called the
excuse me, Brett. Josh, I see you have your hand up. Want to make sure we don't miss anything?
Sure, yeah. If you could help, because I have two screens. You guys are on like the way right of my screen, and I'm sharing on the left. So if you could speak up if anybody has any questions. I'm not
Yeah.
gonna see like hands raised, so I appreciate that.
So Brett, I think so for those of us not familiar with auditor lingo, can you explain what internal controls and going concerns mean in plain English?
So internal controls, think of that as the way you do things. So how you process checks, how you receive money like deposits and donations, and how you process payroll. So as an auditor, I have to evaluate that. So depending on how you do those things, that changes my risk of my audit and the procedures that I do. So like internal control, that's all internal. I just review that. Now, if this were a audit in accordance with government auditing standards, you don't receive any government money. That's where I would have an opinion on your internal control, but that is not what this audit is. This is just a financial statement audit. So I only use my knowledge of internal control to help me design my procedures, and that's it. I don't have an opinion on it. I give you kind of feedback on that through the management comments, and the most common one I have is like segregation of duties. And going off memory, I don't remember if I have that on my letter, but it's the most common one for small nonprofits because it's hard to separate who does what when you just don't have that many, people and hands on deck. So that's internal control. Now, going concern, what that is and why that's important on why management and myself do that evaluation is that's basically to make it as simple as possible as the date of my audit report. So that is May 7th, 2025. So looking 1 year into the future, May 7th, 2026, does management and myself, do we believe that ACAWSO will be around a year from now, given the organization's liquidity, the governance that's in place? It's kind of an overarching kind of everything. So the most common, I get a response from management on how on their own evaluation, and it's like, yeah, we are in the black as far as net income. We have X amount of assets, a small amount of liabilities. We've been around for X amount of years. So there's many ways you can describe that. And then I do my own evaluation based on like liquidity ratios, current ratio, assets to liabilities ratio. So we both, in order to get this type of report, and this is called the going concern basis of accounting. We both have to have a positive evaluation of going concern. If that wasn't the case, you would be on the liquidation basis of accounting. And that basically means you're going to go out of business. There are certain principles that change on the financials, such as like property and equipment. This is typically recorded at cost minus depreciation. But if you were on the liquidation basis, it would be fair market value. That's just one example of how that's different. But there are no issues. ACA is in a really healthy spot. You can see here 1.6 million of assets, 475 of liabilities, net assets 840. Like you're in good shape. So management and myself both had a positive evaluation of going concern is how that works.
We expect the patient to be alive in a year.
Exactly. I agree. So
Got it.
Kelly.
Brett, excuse me, there's another question from Kelly.
My question, I'm not sure where I needed to jump in with it, but I was on this meeting last year, when we met with you also, Brett, and I do recall there being a few items of concern. Are you going to touch on those and see
No,
where
so
we
that's
are
probably
with
the
them?
management letter you're talking about. So I'll just peek over real quick. You're probably referring to like this, where I talk about like a comment on how you can improve. Is this what you're remembering,
Okay.
Kelly? Like, inventory
Possibly.
counts, credit card transaction approvals, things of that nature.
Okay. Yes. This is it.
Okay.
So you're going over that
So
at some
maybe,
point.
yeah. So if I get through everything I talk about and you still have like, oh gosh, you talked about something last year that I haven't touched on, please do speak up. But I think this is probably gonna make sense once we get to that part of it.
Yep, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on
Thank
the audit
you.
report before next spot? And I'll go through these a little quicker because these are just the numbers, and I only had two adjusting entries, and they're both are pretty small. One was a change from prior year, and it was like, I forget what exactly what it was. Do I have the note here? I don't have the note. It was like $1,000. But the other one was one that I got through testing. It was recording a liability amount. So to keep it simple, I do what's called subsequent disbursement testing. So I test transactions that happen after year end. So that's after December 31, 2024. And there was one transaction that was recorded as an expense in 2025 that should have been an expense in 2024. So I had to move that expense back into 2024 and then record the subsequent, payable amount to get that in there. And it was about $14,000 going off memory. Sylvia, if you're still on, you may remember better than I can. But I remember we talked about that because, we obviously don't want any adjusting entries, and that was just one that we had. So, but otherwise, the numbers should be pretty similar if you're kind of in tune with the finance or audit committee or just other financials throughout the board, because otherwise the numbers are the same. Maybe the presentation's a little different because I am doing this in accordance with GAAP, and when you look at things internally, that can be in any way you want, right? Cash basis, this is the accrual basis. So that captures, all the items that you have to have, such as payables, liabilities, prepaids, things of that nature. So you're doing all those things, I'm sure, internally, but there's just more strict presentation purposes in what I'm doing here. So otherwise, what you can see here, so you can see current assets very similar year over year, about $3,000 difference. The one big change here is operating lease right of use assets. And this is an expected decrease because when you sign a lease and when it's a long-term lease that's more than 1 year, you have to record it as right of use asset. And if you're not renewing that lease or doing anything with it, every month you're making a payment on it, this is going to decrease. And then you're also going to see the lease liability decrease as well. So while you see this is not decreasing, you can see that the net of current portion, because this captures the next 12 months of payments, this captures then everything else besides that. So going off memory, I don't remember how much longer you have on that, but just taking a sneak peek. Like I said, note disclosures describe everything in way more detail. There's a lease note here, and then what shows here is you have 3.83 years left on your lease. Last year, 1 year passed by, right? You had 4.83 years left on your lease. So every year you get closer to the lease getting closer to expiring, you're going to see those amounts continue to decrease. So while you see assets decreasing as a whole, so if you're like looking at this, oh my gosh, like sound alarm bells, 1.7 million to 1.6, what's going on? You need to take a look at the liabilities as well, because what's happening here is operating lease right of use assets is decreasing by this, not the same amount, because when there's rent escalations, there's going to be slight differences. But generally, you're going to see the lease liabilities of these two lines being pretty much identical with the operating lease right of use assets also decreasing. So that's the big change I definitely wanted to highlight, because that's, when you're looking at total liabilities and total assets, that's why they're decreasing. And that's why you also don't see a very big difference in total net assets, because there was a slight net income of the year, about $10,000-$11,000, that's reflected within here. But that's why you don't see like a net loss. So even though assets decrease by about 1 million or by about $100,000, your liabilities decrease by about $100,000. So that's how that's kind of related. But otherwise here, like I mentioned, current ratio is really healthy. You're just over 3.0. Most nonprofits want to be kind of in that 1 to 2.5 range at a minimum, and you're above that minimum at 913,000 divided by 302. And then of your net assets, you have a healthy amount and without donor restrictions. So where some organizations get in trouble is they may have a lot of net assets, but a lot of it might be tied into with donor restrictions. Now, when you sell your books, like that's without donor restrictions, so it'll always be that. This is more when someone has a donation in. So like if someone donates, and again, there's no disclosure on this, so let me just take another peek.
This is our International Literature Scholarship Fund.
Yeah,
That's it.
exactly. Leadership
Yeah.
scholarship fund. So like, you had some donations in there, so $37,000. You did expend about $6,000 this year on that. So if you do the net change of that, you had about $17,000, $18,000 in towards that literature scholarship fund. So, it's a small amount, but like I said, some nonprofits are more donation-based. You're more kind of revenue-based when it comes to selling literature and books and things of that nature. But one thing I just want to keep in mind. So even though you may have a strong net asset position, if it's all held within restrictions, it's kind of an illusion in a way. This is the important number. This shows really what's liquid and what you have as an organization. Any
Brett,
questions on that?
excuse me. We have another question, Brett. Kelly?
Yeah, yes, Kelly.
Just a question about the term donor restrictions. Does that so I understand that if somebody's donating and they want it to go specifically to the literature fund, that's considered a donor restriction? Because when I think about it, I think about somebody donating $1,000. I know that this restriction was changed drastically a year or two ago, where somebody could donate a certain amount, but then that amount all of a sudden went from like 5,000 to 50,000. Does that fall under a donor restriction also? That type of
Maybe let me
donation?
give you the most common scenario that I see and what's easiest to track, as an organization. So, these days most people probably donate online. I know some people still send in checks, but like if someone sends a check in and they write in, in the memo of the check, Literature Scholarship Fund, then that is a restriction. So like the organization, when they see that, needs to treat it as such, because like let's say I donated $1,000 towards that fund. Part of like what I do as an auditor is why I check those things is if I see Literature Scholarship Fund on the check memo and they're not tracking it as revenue in for the restriction, obviously that's not a good thing, right? Because any donor that donates should be able to, no, almost none do this, but they should be able to ask like, hey, can you show me how my $1,000 was spent? As kind of like a like what's the report on that? Because if you can't provide that, then it's like, okay, you're not treating the money like you should. Because as a nonprofit, you technically should not even accept the money unless you believe you can fulfill that restriction. So sometimes what happens with nonprofits is they'll get a donation towards some type of purpose. And if you don't think you can do it, or if it was some type of program you did years ago, you have to call the donor and go, hey, can you repurpose this as something else, whether it's unrestricted or a different type of program you're actually doing, versus just accepting the money. Like it's more prudent, or it's better to basically reject the donation if there's that restriction there. Because when you are taking a restricted donation as a nonprofit, you have to say like, okay, yeah, we're going to take this and we're going to use it towards that purpose. So as of now, from what I'm aware of, it's just a literature scholarship fund. So like if there's some donor that comes in and donates 5,000, and let's say it's to strictly pay for salaries for the employees, that's a restriction, because if their money's getting spent on shipping supplies, that's not fulfilling the donor's wishes. And again, if ACA believes like, oh, that restriction is just too much for us, like salaries is probably not that type of restriction, but ACA has the ability to reject the money or give it back if, if it was like a online donation or something of that nature. But once you accept the money, and like if I'm doing like a test of an online donation and it specifically says like towards salaries, that is a donation that it's a restricted purpose and it should be tracked in the audit report. So I didn't see any of that. So like, maybe it's occurring and it's just not in the small sample I'm taking, because I do take a sample of transactions, not testing 100% of things. But yeah, as of this point, it's just a literature scholarship fund.
Thank you.
Answer your question, hopefully.
Yeah, I actually, as we're speaking, I think I was thinking about when somebody passes away and leaves a donation. That's the one that changed drastically, the allowance for that. Thank you.
And when that case, so really I work on just documentation, right? So like if something's verbally happening, I can't really verify that as an auditor. So like if someone passes away and part of their estate plan and money comes in and there's no specifications that it goes toward a restricted purpose, then it's unrestricted. Like it has to say it goes towards something for it to be a restriction. Even if verbally they may have talked about it, 5 years ago, going like, oh, I'd love for it to go towards Literature Scholarship Fund. But if that check gets cut and there's no mention of it, as an auditor, I can't say like, oh, that's a finding because you didn't restrict it, because I don't know what's happening verbally or not. I go what's actually in writing. So
Yeah, thank you.
next page here is the statement of activities. So very similar to an income statement in the for-profit world. So first section here is support and revenue. Why this is important, why this is broken out from non-operating revenue, is I like to separate this out. Inventory sales contributions are the main ones. You didn't have any events and conference income this year. But credit card rewards and interest income is a little more unpredictable year over year, and it's not operating, so that's why it's different. But basically, if you're comparing this to a 990 filing, your support revenue may not match what you're seeing because there's two lines to take into account versus just this top line, which is a lot easier to see than this line down here. Expenses, so that's broken out into program and supporting services, and supporting services is broken out further into management in general and fundraising. Now, you may be looking at this and going, oh, wow, what happened to management general? It went way up compared to last year. I actually like this because last year, like Ken mentioned, and like I mentioned a little earlier, my one significant deficiency was the fact that allocation of functional expenses was happening basically in accounting firm. BPM led the way, and I kind of helped, kind of tie it all together with last year's audit. But, and I told Ken this, probably multiple, Ken probably told this 50 times at this point, like, an organization internally is always going to do a much better job at allocating your expenses versus an outside accounting firm because you know your organization way more than an outside accounting firm. I know what's kind of generally like accepted in a percentage, generally between 70 and 90% is kind of the expected number because anything under 70, if you kind of look at it and go, hey, for every dollar we're spending, 60% is towards programs, like that's probably a little low. If you're over 90%, that's the other way, right? It's like, oh wow, you're really efficient. How can you be that efficient? How are you spending, $95 out of every 100 towards programs? So you want to kind of be that 70 to 90. You're in between that for both these years. Now you're a little lower in that 70. I think you're like 75% in 2024, but I feel way more comfortable with this than last year's. Now, functional expenses are always the biggest financial statement estimate for a nonprofit organization. All the audits that I do on not the management letter that I'm going to go over here. This is kind of a more of an informative letter, but there are two reports I separate out, and this report just goes over the comments of each of those. But there's more literature in that other report that basically talks about significant estimates that I have on the audit. Every single one of my audits, doesn't matter how big or small they are. Allocation of functional expenses is always one of the most significant estimates because, and I think I probably told Sylvia this 20 times. If we had 20 different Sylvias in the room and in her position, and I'm, we're allocating expenses, go, you're going to get 20 different results because there are just so many different ways you can allocate expenses. So now, what I'm looking for is just what's reasonable. And like when I test expenses, I'm looking for reasonableness. The most two common ways you're going to see allocation of expenses occurring is through salary allocations. So how people are spending their time, whether it's program, fundraising, G&A tasks, or through like square footage analysis. So like, if you did that through your rent, the warehouse would be all program, Sylvia's office as, accounting would be G&A. So that's kind of what I'm looking at for an auditor is just reasonableness. If you said 100% was towards program, like in Sylvia's position, that's where I'd push back going, the accounting function is not program related. That's the difference there. So that's why, again, you're seeing such a much bigger number here compared to last year and even a smaller program expense. It's because there's, in my opinion, more accurate functional allocations occurring this year. Yes, two hands.
Yeah, I want to make sure I just get this in plain English. This is explained to me like I'm five kind of thing. I think what this is, what you're getting at here is under expenses, program services versus supporting services is sort of like a, you think of it as a overhead ratio. Is that kind of what you're getting at? Like how much is going out to actual programs versus, salaries versus this, all the things that need to happen in the background to make all that stuff happen. And we're talking about the ratio of those two things. Is that right?
I think that's a very fair assumption. I peek to
Okay.
the next page to show you that because what you see down here, like
Got it.
1.7, 578, these are the numbers that flow into here. A great example is like cost of goods sold. So these are the actual costs of your inventory that's going out. 100% program, 100% program. Like that is very cut and dry. Like there's nothing, that's nothing to do with G&A, nothing to do with fundraising. Now, like when you look at professional fees, because this is a lot of accounting and legal and attorney fees, that has nothing really to do with improving the programs or your mission, like that is very G&A. That's why that's mostly G&A. So you're never, I don't say never. Some nonprofits are kind of lazy with what they allocate here. They'll go like, oh, we'll just do an 80-20 split across all our categories. And I'll usually push back going, you need to differentiate some of those. Like bank charges aren't going to be 80% program generally. And if you do like grants to other nonprofits, that's 100% program. I don't want that 20% G&A. So this is going to give you a much clearer depiction on how these three categories are being broken out. So for example, like I mentioned, professional fees or rent expense, is mostly programmed because, like I said, warehouse is a huge part of what you do, and that's a lot of square footage being used. So now one of the things I will go over in my management letter, and I'll kind of just take a real brief touch here just because it's super relevant to what I'm going over now, is the reason why this is still a comment on my other letter, why it's just a comment to management and not significant deficiency, is there the cost allocation policy, which I put in my current comment, hasn't been fully adopted until April. Actually, I put as of April, it's going to be approved, which I think it did. So once that is official, it kind of drives now internally like how we're going to allocate costs, because even what happened in 2024, the costs were being allocated, but it was done kind of unofficially because the cost allocation plan was still being developed and hadn't been approved by the board yet. So I just want to touch on that real briefly, because if you're looking even at some of these numbers, again, estimates, right? Functional expenses are our estimates. And you're looking at like, hey, why is IT, 54,000 and management general is 23? Like, maybe I expect this to be a little bit higher. You can fall back on your cost allocation policy, and that should tell you why the numbers say what they are. So I'm expecting even next year, because now that the policy will be voted in, I'm expecting the 2025 numbers to be even cleaner with your financial statement estimate on your expenses with the policy now in full effect. Two more questions. Yes.
Go ahead, Corbet. I've already spoken a few times.
Okay. On this page, there's a topic that says payroll taxes. What is that? Thank you.
Yeah, so th think of this as a percentage. So if you're an employee for any company, like if you are paid X amount, you have certain taxes that are withheld. Now, as an employer, you have to match the Social Security ca taxes and the Medicare taxes. There's other miscellaneous taxes, depending on if there's, FUTA, unemployment tax, also for California, or if there's other states involved. But generally, you're going to see payroll taxes anywhere from about 7 to 9% is kind of the given what you're going to see of total salaries and wages. And again, this is the employer match portion. So Social Security is, gosh, I should know, it's 6.2%. I'm 99% sure. If someone looks it up and it's something different, I'll be embarrassed. But I think it's 6.2 Social Security, 1.45 is Medicare. So just right then and there, that's the majority of what you're seeing here for payroll taxes. And the reason why it's on here is ACA is paying that portion. The employee is paying the other half of that, and that's already included within salaries and wages because they're getting that deducted from their paycheck. I'm probably getting a little too much detail here, but basically, payroll taxes, Social Security, Medicare for generally, that's the majority of it. Kelly or Kathy?
Go ahead, Kathy. I'll yield to you.
Hi, everyone. Kathy, Region 2. I have a question about, hang on, sorry. I just, there's the payroll increase went up almost $100,000. Can you explain that respectfully?
Yeah, so going off memory, I don't recall. Sylvia, are you still on? Maybe you know this better than I do, just going off memory. I think that, generally I see expenses increasing on salaries because there's typically rate like cost of living increases already baked in. So I'm falling back on that just on just generalities. But Sylvia, you have anything to add there just based on my discussions with you for the audit? I can look at my work papers separately. I'll just stop my share to do that real quickly if needed.
How much was the payroll increase? Okay, 31.
Just go
So
to about 674.
so 674, that was an addition of staff, I believe. I would have to double check when we had to bring in somebody to help out in accounting
Hey, Sylvie, when did you
for the year.
start last year? I feel like it's your position that's part of that as well. Because I feel like you started in the middle of 2023. So we're going to see a full year of expense for you in here, and that would have not been in here last year.
Yeah,
That's accurate.
there was a combination of things here. It's a little bit of my salary there where it wasn't someone was more part-time and an additional staff. But yeah, it's really hard to tell without going back and looking at the notes.
Okay, so employee benefits rose over 80% last year. Was that increase primarily due to the change in the retirement match, or were there other benefits added?
What I remember for employee benefits is there was a retirement match increase, and there was an increase in health insurance.
Yeah,
Okay.
my memory is exactly the same from what I
Okay.
recall looking at.
The audit states that the board and committee members are unpaid volunteers. During your audit, did you identify payments to board members, trustees, or committee chairs either through payroll contracts or consulting arrangements?
Our board and volunteers, and they're not paid.
Okay. Contracted and professional services, contracted services and professional fees increased by over 135,000 from 2023 to 2024. Did your audit assess whether these expenses were reasonable and free from conflict of interest? Would it be appropriate for fellowship members to request a general description of what those services involved while still respecting confidentiality?
Yeah, so like I know professional fees increased because there were more attorney fees. You know, there were items such as I think copyright issues that came up in 2024. Trying to go again off memory. Sorry, I completed this audit a few months ago. I'm trying to retrain my memory with a lot of these things that happened. But everything that I tested, so this is where I'm hoping auditing changes in the future with AI. Like I typically test about 10 to 15% of transactions. And Sylvie probably thinks that's already too many with how many transactions there are that go through your QuickBooks file. But the numbers you see here are representative of 100% of that population. And what I test is a small percentage of that. Now, with AI, that may increase. So, like, I may be able to identify more issues on things. I didn't find any of those things. So, for example, like contracted services increasing, professional fees increasing, like, everything's lining up from what I'm seeing. But again, I'm taking a sample. You know, that's what auditing's been historically. And that may change in the near future with AI kind of exploding. But to kind of answer your question, like, you know, Kathy, I think you mentioned a few different line items. I didn't see any conflict of
Yes.
interest issues or any of that nature from what I saw.
Okay. Administrative spending and lease commitments, general administrative expenses nearly doubled in 2024. Based on your experience auditing nonprofits, do you see this level of growth as typical? The board discussed that ACAWSO rents a separate building for literature operations. The audit includes a lease liability over $625,000. Is this lease part of that total? And does it appear sustainable given the organization's revenue and reserves?
So the lease is part of that. So the lease is baked into rent expense here. So as the right of use asset gets lower, you know, each year or each month as payment is made, that's reflected within rent expense. And you can see rent expense is majority program expense. Now the biggest change, and I mentioned this a little earlier, is the fact that your expenses are better allocated this year, and that's mostly between salaries and wages. For example, like Sylvia's in accounting. She does not do much anything with programs. And last year, I do think this is an understated number because Sylvia is just one employee and there's other functions like Bill, for example, he's doing G&A things in a day-to-day basis. So that's why you see this number is so much higher than this 84 and why you see 497 here, which is higher than this 381. So that's, you know, there's obviously there's other lines here, but this is the biggest change to why you see that big increase, which again, I see across nonprofits all the time, but especially for you because you had your first audit in a very long time last year. And this 316 number probably is a little lower than it should have been in hindsight. Again, ha having done this last year, I know Kelly, I remember you last year. We didn't know that last year. Maybe next year, having the same conversation, maybe this 578 is a little too high or maybe it's a little too low. We don't know, right? Again, this is a financial statement estimate that we're trying to fine tune and get better every year, given the information that we have.
It's always seemed to me like numbers are pretty straightforward, but I just want to ask you one last question. Based on your audit procedures, do you believe that ACAWSO is complying with its policy that leadership roles are unpaid?
I believe so as your auditor. I mean, there's no absolutes. So, as I mentioned, my audit report, I provide reasonable assurance, not absolute assurance. There's no such thing in auditing standards as absolute assurance. Maybe that changes again one day. Maybe again with AI, I can test 100% of transactions, and I'm able to do that. But as of now, the AICPA, American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, does not allow me as a CPA to say that there's absolute assurance on your financial statements.
I understand. Thank you so much for
Yeah,
your
thanks,
time.
Kathy.
Thank you.
Hey,
Okay.
Kelly or Corbe?
Let me go next. I'm looking on another screen at the 2024 budget as well as the 2025 budget that's posted on our website. And I mean, the numbers on the 2024 budget, I would have thought would have been a little closer to yours that you're showing us here. I mean, for example, travel. On yours, you have 6529, and on the website it says 3,155. Yet 2025 goes up to $40,000 allocated for travel. How
Yeah, we
does
can
that
do a
happen?
quick sneak peek of the financial statements here. So these are my work papers for the audit. And now, are you looking at budget or actual? Like, are you looking at a budget versus actual? Because the budget's never going to match the numbers. But if you're looking at actual numbers, why there may be differences is I'm showing you my grouping schedule. So to keep things really simple, like here's cash. So like here's all the cash accounts. So like when you see this number, this is the cash you see. So like when you go to travel, so that's towards the bottom. Travel is made up of these four accounts. So this 6529 that you mentioned is made up of travel mileage expense, airfare, lodging, events, travel. So I'm not sure if you are seeing these four because this is straight from your QuickBooks file. Like these are the account numbers. So like this 6529 is made up of these four accounts. So I don't know how the numbers that you're seeing on the website are being calculated, but I'm showing you how my numbers are coming from. So this is straight from the QuickBooks file. These are the actual numbers. These are just rounded numbers for the report, but like these are the actual numbers for 12/31/2024 before the audit. Didn't have any adjusting entries. So then this is the report numbers, for your one
I
example.
guess, well, I mean, the contractors on what I'm looking at in 2024 says 1,007, yeah, 174,000 and change. 2025, it's 348,000. And I mean, that's a huge jump, and there's a few huge jumps, but I sort of feel like wouldn't the budget that that is posted on the website for all to look at, wouldn't those numbers be a little more exact? I mean, to be off as much as they are, I mean, I wonder. And
So again, it depends on the groupings. So like I'm showing you what contracted services are for this year. So last year it was very general, one account. This year it was broken out, publishing, translation, IT, social media, accounting. So like again, you're gonna see this 159,813. It's gonna match, right? Like that's exactly what you see
that's for
this year. So
2024. Yeah, for 2024, you have that on the website. It says 174,000. And
I
then
don't
on
know the web.
2024,
I don't know the
yeah.
website. I'm sorry. I don't know how the website's calculated. I go off of what's in the QuickBooks. So this is what's in the QuickBooks file. Now maybe there's different groupings. So maybe there's something else that's down here in a different GL account that's part of this 174. So again, it just depends on how the groupings are done. But I'm calculating it based off of these five numbers right here that you see right here. That's how I get my number.
Okay, I mean, so would it be a question for whoever's posting these budgets on the website why they're not a little more accurate? I mean,
Maybe the question is like, is this from like what's the grouping? Because like for me, like it's a valid question. I get this question all the time. It's like, hey, like how did you calculate rent expense for 166,000? I have a different number, and then I always fall back to the report I'm showing you here because I
right.
can always go back and these are all formulas. So in this case, it's super simple. It's just one line, but
Yeah.
sometimes it can be
Yeah. I mean,
12 accounts that make up one line. But it seems like there's just two methods of what's happening because what you see here is what I'm doing. As your auditor, like I help prepare the financial statements. I don't expect any of my small nonprofit clients to know every single thing about GAAP. Like that's what I do every day, but you are fulfilling your mission. I want you to fulfill your mission. Like I don't expect you to have every single, note disclosure that I have here. Like that's part of what I do, and every nonprofit auditor that deals with organizations of your size, they're going to help you with those things. But one of the downsides of that is there may be some slight differences in groupings. So in the future, if we want to get those more lined up, you have the, obviously you have your trial balance, you know what that is, you have your QuickBook file, and we can adjust that. So then, again, I'll pick on contracted services. If we want different types of accounts in here to be under contracted services, and I agree with that, I'm okay with that. I'm going on very generalities. Like when I saw contractors, I'm like, okay, that's contracted services. I'm putting that there. Or technology IT, I'm going to throw that in information technology. I'm not overthinking things. Again, it's just the way different things are being grouped. So sorry, it's not a perfect
Yeah,
answer,
no.
but it's just the way it's being
Right.
grouped is
It, well, they,
what's going on.
there's a lot of the same categories on the budgets that are posted. They're just the numbers are, I mean, in 2025, the numbers, I mean, contractors is 348,000. That's a big jump from.
Yeah, with 2025, I have not looked at anything yet, so I couldn't help you with
Yeah, I
that.
know.
So this is just
Right.
2024. But yeah, I get what you mean.
Yeah. So it just seems there's a lot of wiggle room here. Thank you.
Corbe? You're
Hi,
muted if you're. There you
Brett.
go.
I
Sorry.
just want to thank you for all the work you've done, and it's amazing. And I appreciate you making time available for us today. And just want to remind our group that Brett's not involved in our policy or board decisions, that he's just reviewing numbers that were given to him. And he's only reviewed, as he said, 10 to 15%. He takes a random sample. So these numbers are just what he's not involved in policy. Okay, thank you.
That's great. Appreciate that. Any other questions on? I'll jump back into this. And, I kind of skipped ahead of that. But any other questions on the statement of activities? I kind of went over what I wanted to go over. Talked about net income already. 11,000 last year's 94,000. Seen trends up. For several years with ACA there, with net asset increases. But otherwise, yeah. Any other questions with the statement of activities before I go real quickly on this? Because I know we kind of hit this quite a bit already. Ken.
Yeah, Brett, I just wanted to circle back. You had made the comment about the cost allocation system of not being sure that it was approved or not. And it was approved on 6-5 at the board meeting and recorded. And I sent notification out on that. So it has been approved.
Awesome.
Thanks,
Glad to hear
Ben.
that.
That was a question from me, too.
So otherwise with the functional expenses, like I said, financial statement estimates, total expenses went up, 2.1 to 2.3 million. A lot of that is salaries related, for some professional fees that were mentioned, contracted services. But otherwise, I'm hoping next year, because now that the policy has been approved, June 5th, that we'll see even better financial statement estimates next year for this. Next here's the last statement before the notes. So this is the statement of cash flows. I always like to describe this statement very straightforward. And you want to know where cash is going? This is where to look. So for the year, you had a net decrease of $72,000. You had a drop from 467 to 394. You can always tie these numbers back to the statement of financial position. So like if you see the 394 here, when you go back to this first one, you're going to see 394 or 467 last year. That's our starting point this year or last year's ending number. So what you then start with is you start with your net income or net loss. Again, the net income that I discussed in the last two pages. Now, the reason why it's a net loss is basically this and this. So or actually not even this, it's really just this, because you look at these bigger numbers like operating lease liability, $138,000. That's offset by the right of use asset amortization. So I was going over that on the statement of financial position when I was talking about the big changes from here to here. That's what's being reflected on this portion of it. But like purchase of intangible assets, like website related activity. I'm trying to think on the top of my head what else there was. Again, Sylvia, you may know better on the top of your head. But like, inventory increases, that's another big one. So you had inventory increase $46,000. Another way to look at this too, it's a summarized version. So like if you see 46,000 here, you could do the same math by looking at the change from year over year in some of these categories. So like when you see inventory increase by this or accounts receivable increase by $5,000 to $6,000, you're going to see those same changes here. Now, for accounts receivable, it'll tell you like increase decreases, where increases in those numbers are bad things for the cash flows, because if you have more in receivables, that's a good thing here, but it's a bad thing in actually receiving the cash you have in hand. So really, that's a summary of this. I mean, you can look at each line kind of on your own time, but if you're ever looking here and you're like, where did the cash go? Yours is not that different, but I've had some organizations where cash might drop 200,000 and net income is, 200,000 plus, right? Like that's a $400,000 swing. I always tell them, look at the cash flow statement. Like, what's happening here? And you may look and it's, oh, we paid $400,000 in debt. We paid off our mortgage that year. That's why we don't have any cash. So you just have to look at the cash flow statement to see where your cash is going. So, and the last thing on here before I start with the notes, or if anybody has any questions, this number here, I like to add this in for restricted cash and cash equivalents. This number is just going to tie out to your net assets with donor restrictions, just to give a little more kind of clear, transparent look on like out of your total cash position, what actually is unrestricted? Because sometimes, again, it could be a little misleading if not separating this, because you might think, oh wow, we got 394,000 to spend. But if you had, 300,000, again, hypothetically, if you had 300,000 sitting with donor restrictions, most of it's tied up towards specific purposes. So, it's kind of a le little less of a rosy look when it comes to there. But yeah, that's it for the cash flow statement. Any questions before jumping to the notes? I don't see any hands. Okay, I'll go to the notes. I'll go through these a little quicker. These are very similar to last year. The note disclosures don't change much. The numbers may change. I'll go through any spots that do change significantly. But note one just talks about ACA in more detail. So this is a note that comes straight from you. I'm not a writer by chance. I'm definitely an accountant. I am not a writer. So I may go off your website as a starting point, but this is the stuff that if you want to implement and improve, I'm going to lean on you guys to doing that. Note two, on the other hand, it is a lot of writing, but this is US GAAP. Like I mentioned in my audit report, these accounting policies are going to be followed amongst everybody that follows GAAP. So, like when you're reading about the net assets without donor restrictions, or net assets with donor restrictions, or cash and cash equivalents, if you look at these policies next to five other nonprofits like you, you're going to be like, oh my gosh, are we plagiarizing up off everyone? Like, why is this worded the same way? It's because this is how accounting works, right? It's very black and white, and that's how it works and how it's done. So if you look at last year's report, you're going to be like, wow, Brett didn't change much here. It's because you didn't change your policies, because accounting is not changing year over year for the most part. Now, what is changing, and it will be disclosed, and I think because this is comparative, I think I do have something here possibly. Yeah, for credit losses. And credit losses don't impact you pretty much at all. I said it did not have a material impact. This is a new rule on receivables for the year, or not for the year, but like when you have receivables from inventory, the credit loss rules that were started recently has a forward-looking aspect to it, where the historical allowance for bad debt or allowance for doubtful accounts only had a historical look back period. This one is a more forecasting as well. So like as of the date of inventory, these credit losses now have the effect of, okay, like instead of just looking back at like how well have they paid us in the past, if we know like the economy's in a bad spot, or like they may not pay us a potential amount, we have to now look forward and go, okay, we may not collect a certain percentage because of current factors and future factors versus historical. So why I'm touching on this is, yeah, when you look at the note two, the last section or two recently adopted accounting pronouncements, this is where your accounting rules are potentially changing. Everything above this, not changing. Now, what I will mention is, and I try to do this for all my audits, and if you can call me out if I'm missing something here, but when you look at these headers like cash equivalents, accounts receivables, inventories, my goal here is to have a header for pretty much all accounts that you have on your statement of financial position, and the revenue piece. The expenses is a little overkill. Like I'm not going to talk about insurance because people understand what insurance is. But the goal here is like if you're wondering like what is inventory, what is prepaid expenses, what is deferred revenue, what exactly is events and conferences, the goal is to, in note two, you find that heading and you can like read what it means. So then you can understand like, okay, like I understand what inventories is now. Or like I said before, if I go down to the revenue note, events and conference revenue just talks about what that is. And so my goal is to have a line there so then the financials have some support and backup on what that means. So that's why note two is so kind of in depth. Note two starts on page 7 and it goes all the way to page 14. So 7 pages of just how you do your accounting. So that's note two. Note three is liquidity and availability. So this is the liquid assets you have over the next 12 months. We start with cash equivalents, your accounts receivable. Those really are your only financial assets that are what I call liquid. Now, inventory, in my opinion, is also very liquid, but the generally accepted accounting principles, they kind of single out inventory, property and equipment, prepaid. Like, even though you could sell property and equipment, like equipment that you have, like computers, and you could sell inventory, it for the sake of this note, it is not a liquid asset. So that's why you're not going to see, your very high number of inventory here. But what this shows you is then you have $403,000 in cash and receivables as of year end. That 37,000 I've talked quite a bit already is that net asset with donor restriction number, the Literature Scholarship Fund. So this is what's available for general use. So how I'd like to compare this number, and I always mention this number in all my reports, is I like to look at this number and compare it to your total expenses. So if you didn't have a single dollar come in from a new donor or didn't make an inventory sale, comparing this 366 to your total expenses on the statement of activities here of 2.3, you do the math, right? So you take that number, divide it by total expenses. I'm looking, what, a few months of viability in the organization when it comes to being able to survive. So, but again, that's unrealistic, right? You're making inventory sales every day, but that just kind of gives you perspective of like how long you could survive without generating an extra dollar. Note four just talks a little more in detail on your inventory. So, a lot of these other notes, and I'll go through these a lot quicker. If again, you want to know what the 446 means on the statement of financial position, like, hey, what is this? These note disclosures are going to tell you, like, oh, that's what inventory is, right? So the 446 is mostly made up of literature and workbooks and a small amount of Mendelian chips and others. So just gives you perspective on how that number is computed. Same thing with prepaid expenses. You can see that detail here, property and equipment, machinery and equipment, furniture and fixtures. So, yeah, I mean, again, it's going through. These are all statement of financial position items that give you a little more detail on what things are happening. And why I like comparative financials, this is not required by generally accepted accounting principles. It's a recommendation, it's a best practice, but I always push all my clients to show this comparative presentation because last year you just had one column for these, right? And I'm hoping this is helpful where you can kind of see the changes in some of these numbers so you can kind of see some trends going on. So that's why it's added in. This is where it's super helpful in the notes. So you could see like, oh wow, we had a big IT prepaid expense change here, So it just gives you that more detail that, if you were just looking at this one column and this was totally not there, you don't have anything to kind of compare it to from last year's audited numbers. So moving forward, note seven, intangible assets. Note eight, accrued liabilities. Again, all these numbers are tying back to your statement of financial position. Note nine talks about that retirement plan, and someone mentioned, I forget who, about the retirement plan increase. So that did increase to 3%. That's why you saw the higher employee benefits on the statement of functional expenses. So that's disclosed here. You can see the slightly higher matching percentage as well. So this is the portion that ACA is matching. So this does not include the employees contributing themselves. This is just ACA doing the matching portion of that. So pretty big increase again, because we're seeing that 3% instead of the 1%. Note 10, so this is the right of use asset and operating lease note. This just goes through the next 4 years. I touched on that 3.83 years that you have remaining on your office lease. The way this interest is computed, it's kind of weird, but the new lease rules make you kind of calculate an interest portion. So then you have a present value portion of the payments. Because you're supposed to have a weighted average discount rate when the lease starts. To make a long story short, everybody that follows GAAP has to do this, but these rules were meant for the big companies that were hiding like hundreds of leases off their balance sheets or the statement of financial position. So your books probably wouldn't be too different with this lease off your books, but these are all required disclosures. So if you're looking at this going like, why is this relevant? It's because the Walmarts of the world, the Apples, they might have thousands of leases that weren't shown as liabilities that are now shown as liabilities. And we're following the same rules, right? We all play the same game on GAAP. So that's why this is disclosed. So it's a pretty heavy note disclosure for something that just shows you have 4 years of lease right of use of that building there. So again, these numbers are tying back. This 475, 149, this is on the statement of financial position. I won't peek back just because I do feel like this is going a little longer. But yeah, that's what that is. Note 11, you have this note that's going to be paid off July 2025. $7,000 left on that. Last year's audit had, 2 years left of payments. So you're just continuing on that payment schedule. Note 12, that literature scholarship fund we talked about a little earlier, $12,000 increase, and then $6,000 that's been expended for 2024. Credit risk concentration. So this is just based on the FDIC limits. So $250,000 is the what's insured per bank, per account, or if I say per account category. So what I mean by that is if you have $1 million in cash and it's $250,000 in four different banks, you would have nothing that's uninsured. But if you have $500,000 in cash and $250,000 is the limit, and you have one bank, then $250,000 would be uninsured. So you have $62,000 that's uninsured as of year end for 2024. Organization doesn't believe there's any risk. You bank with some pretty reputable banks. No banks that are likely to go under, because even if a bank is in bad spot, when it's a bigger bank, the government usually comes in and bails them out because they know how much of a disaster it would be if a bigger bank were to go under. So, but we still require to be disclosed to give an idea of a worst case scenario that if the banks were to come down, the government's only going to insure you up to $250,000 per insured bank. And then the last note disclosure just says that my audit procedures are through May 7th, 2025, as far as understanding major significant events that may have occurred, and there were none that I was aware of or that management was aware of. So that's the audit. Any further questions on that before jumping on the management letter?
Yeah, Kelly had her hand up for a while. Kelly?
Okay. Sorry, Kelly. I
That's
was just
okay.
rambling.
That's okay. I was you talk fast and my brain was just trying to keep up. So
No,
did you
sorry. Yeah,
say
sorry about that. Everybody tells me that. I apologize.
That's okay. Did you say that the literature in the warehouses is not considered an asset?
Not considered a liquid asset. So for this liquidity note, those are specified as not liquid. I disagree personally. Like I have to follow GAAP. I believe you could probably sell your inventory in a week and get a significant amount of money for it, but
Right.
for the liquidity purposes, it's cash and receivables. The only other item that would be on here if you had it would be investments. So like if you had equities and mutual funds, that would also be on here. Everything else that's an asset is pretty much not going to be on here. Because for by the letter of GAAP, that FASB Financial Accounting Standards Board put together, they don't specify those as liquid. So they are assets. They absolutely are assets. Like you look at your financial position,
Well,
like
that's
yeah,
where
they
we make all
are
our money.
they're assets. They're just
That's
not
where we make
liquid
all our
by the
money.
definition.
Okay. Gotcha. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, just quick. You said something, there was something there in the note about a note being paid off. For those of us not knowledgeable about that lingo, is that, are you talking about paying off a loan?
Yeah, I'll take another sneak peek. Again, this has been a couple months. I'll have something in here. Give me a sec. And Sylvie, you can jump in if you're still on here. Navitas.
Was it that, we had a note for some software that is being paid off mid this year?
Yeah, there's been no deviation from this now. So like last year, 2023, like you can see it's something you've had since 2022. Like you're just making this $1,118 payment like clockwork. So you can see here, this is your, it's probably way too small. Let me zoom in a little bit. So as of December 2024, this is your balance. Like that's what you're seeing. And then these are the next 7 months of payments you're going to see. So, we're kind
Gotcha.
of like right here, right? So we probably just made this payment. We probably have one more payment, to make. Or maybe we made our last payment. I don't know if, how that kind of works in the timing there. But by this time next year, you shouldn't see anything on this part of the on this part of the audit. So I go back here. This portion right here, notes payable, should go away. That's why this went away, right? Like this is this number last year. It's just getting brought forward to your, this is now the current portion. This
Oh, got it,
number
got
is
it.
what,
Okay.
that's the
Thank
number
you.
again. Yeah, the notes. I always have a, I wish I had a better example. There's a better example than like it's not a cherry on top. It's just like the dressing on a salad, right? Like this is just going to give you more detail on what's happening, but that's where this number's coming into, right? Like that number's tying to the financials. But yeah, Navitas, that's what I was blanking out on. Navitas is the who's who you're paying back.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. So then this other one's the management line. This is probably where you get a lot more value out of my services. So audit's great. You know, I try to do the best I can there, but this is where you can improve going forward. So, as I mentioned, and it's been mentioned quite a bit, there was one significant deficiency last year. That's not the case this year, right? None. No material weaknesses, no significant deficiencies. Now I'll define these for the group because you may not know what these are. So a material weakness is a deficiency or deficiencies in internal control in which internal control may not prevent, detect, or correct errors on a timely basis. So to make that in plain English, your internal controls should be designed to catch errors, right? So, like whether it's management review, separating duties, like putting in IT and technology to catch errors, like those are your internal controls, the way you do things. So, if those are designed to prevent, detect, and correct errors, you don't have any material weaknesses. So, you don't have any of those. And what a significant deficiency is a deficiency or deficiencies in internal control that is less severe than a material weakness, but it's important enough to merit attention to those charged with governance. So what that means is it absolutely should be disclosed to governance, right? Like, hey, like this is something that's a big deal, not a material weakness, but governance needs to be aware that as of last year, like functional expenses, you need to get a policy together, you need to allocate it yourself internally, and you took it seriously, that got mitigated in 2024, right? Like, and I expect this comment to go away next year because the reason why, again, why it's on here is it just hadn't been formally adopted, and it's been formally adopted as of early June. So, the reason why that's different because this comments to management, and I'm probably on the higher spectrum of this. Of I'm nitpicky with this stuff because again, I feel like this is where value is added. This is going to be nitpicky. This is not nitpicky. Significant deficiencies, material weaknesses. This is like you need to take this very, very seriously because there are some internal control things going on that you know the board needs to be aware of. If they're not aware of, that management needs to take seriously. So. As of 2024, there are none of those. So awesome job. You know, that great job by the organization. But there are, you know, quite a bit of comments here, which I'll go over on just again, best practice, nitpicky me of doing these things. So now the way these are organized is if there is a prior comment, so because you've only had 2 years of audits, they're all going to have a 2023 beginning or a 2024. I'm hoping all these get, you know, resolved in future years, which I'm sure they are. You know, your organization is one of the best when it comes to taking all these very seriously. But at my old firm that I've been at for almost 10 years, I had some that were, you know, if we were in 2025 like we are now, there may be like a 2015 here. And it's like, it's been a comment for 8 years. And it's just like, you know, it's not a serious one. Like maybe it's something that's super minor, but it's one of those things like, hey, just fix it, you know, clean it up. And, you know, but they don't. And, but that's what this first thing means. And what this second one means, this is the first comment of that year. Or, you know, as I work down the second comment or third comment. So, like, why number two is not here? Number two got resolved in this year. So, now I know I put this one together. Yeah, there's this prior that's been resolved section. So, most of these have been resolved. That's why, like, when you see the 02 one resolved or the next one, 004. So, that's why when I go through these, if you see gaps, like when I go from one to three to five, I guess five got resolved too. There's really, yeah, there's just two comments that are left. So, let me just go through these now, before I again start just rambling more. So allocation of functional expenses, reason why it's still on here, you need to get the policy approved. It got approved. So unless there are some reason why I believe you're not following your implemented policy, this comment should go away for next year's audit. Next one, and I think this one's also being implemented. Sylvia, maybe you can jump in. So donor software and tie-out. So the donor software is in the works. I don't know if it's been approved yet. I know I talked to the IT person, Brad, quite a bit. I've talked to Sylvia about it, talked to Bill. I don't remember if I put the software
It's
on there that you were looking into.
been installed.
Okay.
There's just a few tweaks, but it's actually live.
Awesome. So this one's another one that's probably going to go away next year. So, but I'll
Yes.
summarize what this is. So, as of year end, there's been a manual process in reconciling your seventh tradition contributions. Now, contributions is the biggest risk in revenue for a nonprofit organization because, like, when you make an inventory sale and that person does not get their book, they're probably going to call you, right? Or contact
You're
Amazon, like, hey, I didn't
we
get my
can't
book.
hear
Like,
you.
what's going on here? Am I muted?
I can hear
Can you hear
you.
me?
I can
I
hear
can
him.
hear him. Okay, sorry. So yeah, so like if you make an inventory sale, someone's gonna call you, right? Or call Amazon, right? Like there's a good checks and balance there. The only checks and balance with the contribution is a donor acknowledgement letter. So why, where donor software is really key for, so as an auditor with donor software, I know that those can't be modified as much as a manual spreadsheet when it comes to like, oh yeah, that person got notified, or like, because you know, it just happens, right? Like you can give me whatever you want. I'm coming in after the fact. I'm coming in the year later, or you know, a few months after year end to look at things. But the best organizations that have this really tightly under control, and you're well on your way to having the software, is you run a report in your donor software that says, we have $600,000 of contributions in 2025. And then you go to your QuickBooks software, there's $600,000 of contributions in here because the donor acknowledgement letters come from the donor software that says 600,000. And then the QuickBooks file says there's $600,000 of donations. And that makes me feel all warm and fuzzy as an auditor, because that means every person that got a donor acknowledgement letter, you got the money. Because my biggest fear as an auditor is there are people getting donor acknowledgement letters that you're not getting the money for in your QuickBooks file. Because once that donor gets their net donor acknowledgement letter, they assume you got the money. They just think it's in your bank account, but that's not always the case, you know? And as an auditor, I can't catch that because I'm seeing what's on bank statements. So I'm doing my testing based on completeness on like what's in there. And if I ask for a list of donor acknowledgement letters, like I don't know if it's legit or not necessarily because it's a manual process. But if it's a donor software that has, you know, strong override of controls where someone can't, you know, d generate a donor acknowledgement letter and then immediately delete it to, you know, delete the audit trail, then you can't do it that way, right? Like that's the checks and balances in place. So that's where this comment comes in, and why that's so important is having that automated piece in place prevents anyone from generating that letter, giving it to donor, and then back pocketing that check and depositing in their own bank account. Because unfortunately, banks are pretty bad at checking names. This is at my old firm. It was called Anisco and Scholes, and we had a check image that was sent to us. The person who cashed the check, it was nothing like Onisco and Scholes. It wasn't like someone opened a bank that had like one letter missing, and the bank just deposited the check, like no problem. So it's one of those things where this is just a good thing to have in place, especially as, because separate tradition contributions, it's just increased. Like you guys have done a really good job in getting members and people to donate to that. And I'd hate for money to leak out of it somehow just because this is a manual process and being able to reconcile that. So again, great step in getting that, you know, implement. I'm looking forward to seeing that implementation for next year's audit. So those are the only two comments that are still existing. Everything else was resolved this year. So I'm going to go through these a lot quicker, and then I'll open up kind of for just general questions. But so inventory count last year, I say last year, I did it for this year's audit as well. I do a physical inventory observation at your end to observe ACA employees counting inventory at the warehouse, making sure they do a good job. They are recording the counts properly on count sheets. I take copies of those sheets. I do my own test count to make sure that I'm counting the same numbers that they are. So last year there was only one person counting. That was the big one, was just one person counting, because there's more human error when it comes to one person counting many, many boxes and, you know, in a warehouse. Whereas if two people are counting, they can cross-check each other, and there's a high chance that if there is a difference, you're going to resolve that difference correctly. Because there's two independent counters that are being done there. So for this year's inventory count, as I say here, I did note two individuals were counting along with my independent observation. So I was happy to see that because just gives me again that warm fuzzy feeling inside, knowing that the inventory is more likely to be the right number because there's two counters that are involved. And then next one, credit card transaction approvals. So last year, there are some non-recurring transactions that were reviewed after the fact. But for this year, that credit card transactions that I had sampled were all properly supported, and they were all approved by Bill, your general manager. So another thing that the organization took seriously that got resolved. Next one, bank reconciliation and statement review and approval. So I always prefer, and this is again probably a nitpicky comment, but general manager or executive director or whoever is kind of that top management position, I always prefer for the whoever that is to review the bank statement and reconciliation, because they generally know what's going on with the organization. And where a lot of fraud occurs is obviously with cash, right? So like if there are checks being cut to people that we don't know who they are, or if not as much money is being received as should, the general manager should generally know if things are off. So I made that recommendation, and through Adobe Sign. So I love Adobe Sign because electronic signatures tie back to email addresses. That was being performed by the general manager for this year. So another one resolved. Great job. Next one, journal entry approval. So this one, probably my most common comment or one of my most common comments where someone makes a journal entry. So Sylvia, I know you're on the call. Typically the accountant makes a journal entry. Someone else was hired to help Sylvia. So there's now a lot of cross-checking between Sylvia and this other person. Sylvia, I'm totally blanking on her name right now. I totally apologize. But the second person checks Sylvia's work. Sylvia checks the other person's work. Bill steps in, checks in when he needs. So instead of one person doing all the journal entries, and why this is important is journal entries have so much flexibility in an accounting software to enter any debit or credit that you want. And the transaction cycle of that typically has lower internal controls, meaning there's less approvals in place. So while credit cards maybe have all kinds of level of approvals, like you use bill.com as an example, journal entries don't. You know, it's they can just be entered in the QuickBooks and boom, you're done. So this is now being reviewed and approved based on my sample that I took. So that's why that has also been resolved. Next one's fixed asset tagging, another nitpicky one. So just tracking your fixed assets through tags. So like if you have computers and furniture, doing counts of those so you know they're not just, you know, they can't walk away, but you know, someone takes them and physically, you know, removes them and they're not being not, you know, untracked again. So they're now being tagged and tracked, annual counts being done on those fixed assets. So another thing that I put last year and it's now being done. Governance policies. So I talked about conflict of interest policy. I talked about needing a formal document instruction policy. Let's see what else is on here. Approval of general manager, bills, salary. So a lot of things I recommended last year. And for this year, found that board members were disclosing conflict of interest. There now has the record management and retention policy, and that bills of salary was being approved by the board. So again, sound like a broken record here, but that got corrected. And then general IT controls, I believe, is my last one. So I had many calls with your IT person, Brad. Nicest guy, right? Like I knew what he was calling, I knew what he's calling about. It was all related to these comments. So your organization for your size is doing a really good job with your IT. And IT is one of the most neglected areas, in my opinion, when it comes to cybersecurity, because once someone's in your system, if you're not detecting that, you know, who knows how long they can wreak havoc. So I mentioned, you know, penetration testing, you know, understanding how your firewalls work. So if someone is in your system, you know they're in your system, so you can kick them out. And I believe the end result was you weren't going to do penetration. Yeah, I put it at the end. No plans to conduct penetration testing because the cost benefit was not there. But you're doing so many things to prevent bad actors from coming in, strong passwords, dual authentication when needed. So like that's being implemented. And most nonprofits don't do that. Like most nonprofits, they have no policy in place. They just let employees have all kinds of access to on their personal computers and on their cell phones. So like Brad took it very serious. So Brad, you know, I don't think Brad's on the call here, but he did a really good job in helping do this. And you know, through the many phone calls that he had, got clear understanding of what I meant through this comment here on improving that. So just another area again where this has been resolved. So to summarize this, of all the comments we had last year, there are still two ongoing ones, which they're both, you know, right in place, right? Donor software and the policy that's now for the cost allocation. So this may be a lot quicker next year for the management letter, unless there's other things coming up that are not on my radar. ACA is growing a ton, so maybe there are things that you will be doing that I haven't tested the last couple of years. But the fact you're taking these so seriously shows why these have been resolved, right? Like there's been a ton of work behind the scenes. I know this on why I'm reporting this way, versus like I mentioned that other nonprofit that had a comment from 2015 that just I'm not their auditor anymore, but it wouldn't shock me if they still have that comment just based on knowing that who's there. So. Oh yeah, questions. I've got Kelly and Corbet. I'm gonna stop my share as well. Is it okay if I stop my share so I can see everybody kind of in a big
I'll
screen
leave it
again?
right
Yeah.
there because that's where my
No?
question
Okay.
is,
Okay.
or concern. Hi, I'm Corbet in California, with Region 6. And Brett, you've done an outstanding job. This really is amazing, very impressive and detailed. And you are definitely a numbers guy, and that's awesome. We need you. So thank you. I'm not sure if it's really for you or just that, pointing out that you did find in your report that the best practice is to have all employees sign a conflict of interest form annually, because during my review, I found that the finance committee, which was comprised of 5 members, 3 of which were paid staff that were voting on an annual budget, which included their salaries. So in our own OPPM, that is the is, in my estimation, deemed a conflict of interest. And I'm just pointing that out too, that we might want to have a further review of employees being able to look at their conflict of interest. Thank you.
Observation, I will say the reason why this is also resolved, and the reason why I put this on here is your Form 990, the report that gets publicized on GuideStar, CauseIQ, all kinds of different websites, IRS website, they specifically ask about board members and management, particularly. It's not other employees, but management, board members on having a policy that's being followed, because they're typically the ones that are going to have those conflict of interest. And because they're the kind of the decision makers, that's where you see a lot of those related party transactions go kind of the wrong direction, and where nonprofits get their tax exempt status revoked, because it's usually those parties where something's occurring. So having that as a minimum is a good thing. So, but I don't think it's a bad thing to have employees needing to do that. In some cases, is it overkill? Possibly. But if there's someone on, voting on a budget, I think that's a very reasonable reason to have someone needing to have a conflict of interest policy just in case. Yeah, someone's family member is, being approved as part of the budget. And again, people that have that conflict, you just have to disclose it, maybe abstain from the vote, but it's better than nothing, right? So while this is resolved, I think internally you can still do many things I don't recommend here. It's not an all-encompassing list of things you can improve on. But if it triggers ideas, like I may have mentioned the prior year on having employees, or if it was discussed verbally, you absolutely could do those things. Just because I don't list it here, feel free to keep improving, right? Like there are so many ways. Ken, I know you've emailed me different resources. Like I'm sending you all kinds of emails on how you can improve. Keep doing those things. That's a good thing. Yes, Kelly.
A few things. The donor software first. I wrote a couple things down as you were talking. The donor software, would that be, and if you can leave that page there, because I also want to comment on that page. The donor software, I had somebody in my meeting that called me. She's got an automatic debit out of her account monthly to donate. She needed this for the IRS. And it was a little problematic. And this was like a year ago, problematic her getting that, what she needed. Would this donor software make that process much more easily accessible online?
Should.
Is that,
It should
yeah?
absolutely. To kind of back up everybody, I started my own firm as a specifically only audit about 19 months ago. At my old firm, I was doing probably 80% audit, 20% consulting. So as time goes on, I'm not playing around with kind of the softwares as much because I am no longer kind of an accounting consultant. So as the time goes on, I'm getting a little less, detail oriented when it comes to these donor softwares, but going off my memory, and it's probably just improved since back then. You can set it up where, like, if someone makes a donation and like a recurring donation, an automatic email goes out and that person gets that donor acknowledgement letter. So that is absolutely something a donor software should be able to do. So then if someone needs their records of like, oh, I need proof of this donation for my tax return or whatever it may be, the donor software should take care of that automatically, and you don't have to rely on staff to go, oh, I need to send that another monthly acknowledgement letter because someone made that monthly donation. So that is absolutely something that it should do. Sylvia, maybe you know that and can say that, or maybe it's something we'll just have to play with because I know it's still very new at this point.
Yeah, in summary, the old donor software was basically if it was a check, it was actually us, depositing the checks and writing out the letters and sending those out. We did have a tracking system to try to get closer to where we needed to be, but it wasn't, it's nothing like the donor software. And the challenge before was that we needed the exact information to track down the check, when it was deposited, to find the information so that we can send out the letter. With the new system, if someone is missing a letter, we just log into their account and press a button, and it could be emailed or mailed to them right away.
Okay, so that it basically the short answer is yes. This
Yeah.
software would provide that. That's okay. Thank
That's
you.
the benefit. Yeah, the new software is a big leap forward. It's,
Okay,
yeah.
I don't want to take up too much time because I have a couple more questions. Just the approval of transactions by more than one person, and the approval of journal entries by more than one person. Is it, can I get confirmation? Would that be the general manager and now Sylvia also? Are those the two people that are doing the approvals of those entries?
So the
So for,
approval,
yeah, go for it.
I can summarize it. Anything that is cash related, which is a high risk item, is all general manager. So those two, I am either reviewing, I'm always doing something with anything related to cash, but Bill does look at every single cash account and approves it. The minor journal entries, let me give you an example, like a prepaid monthly amortization. That's between Sarah and I. We don't allow any transaction to go through as a journal entry or reconciliation without two people actually reviewing and approving.
Okay, but Bill does the big one, and he's the only one that approves.
He approves 100%. I review and he approves.
Okay. Back to the conflict of interest. I also, to Corbet's point, when you have committees that are approving things like the budget and the committees are made up by paid staff, would you consider that a conflict of interest, Brett? And I'm wondering, is there any oversight? I mean, yes, board members are now disclosing any conflict of interest, but is there any oversight on that? I mean, would you consider that a conflict of interest? Just as a general question, if you have committee members that are paid staff approving a budget.
See, now that you mention it, I absolutely. It's kind of like, oh man, I need to go back to other clients that are part of the committees, because the most common one I see is finance committee. Now, the one that now this is where maybe a little different with how ACA does it. So how I commonly see like a finance committee is like person like Sylvia's position. So like controller or CFO or whatever the title may be, they're invited as a guest to the finance committee. So they're not a member. They're still a part of every meeting, but they're technically a guest. So that like if it comes to voting like on something like the budget, they just sit back and everybody else approves. So that's
Okay,
probably
that's
why I
interesting.
have in my head it's a little different. So I don't know how that works and how that so.
Okay, so would you think that there would need to be oversight on those committees if there is voting? I mean, I understand you can be a
If
guest.
they're voting, I think they should. And that's where I probably should take a little closer look next time, right? So like if they're actually voting, so I've more focused on the board minutes. I get the finance committee minutes, I read those, make sure there's nothing major in those, and I look at the major decisions, but I'm not digging into every finance committee decision. But when it's someone's voting on something, I do believe, yes, you're correct, there is a conflict there, because especially if it's a smaller committee, right? Like let's say it's a three-person committee and two are employees, they have the majority, right? Like they can make any decision they want, and there's nothing preventing them from being committee members. But I would say like most nonprofits, and I'm on two boards and they run this same exact way, is we have our staff, when it's applicable, like a finance person at every meeting, but they are guests to the meeting. They are not a tip, they're not an actual member of the finance committee. So like I said, when we vote for a budget or a mid-year budget if needed, they're not voting. They're not part of that process. They're just part of the help explain the budget because they help put it together. They help answer questions, but then yeah, they do not partake in a vote.
Okay, they can participate, they just can't vote. Thank you.
Yeah, Josh.
Looks like Sylvia's trying to say something, perhaps in response. Go
Yeah.
ahead.
So whenever we put a budget together, most of the budget is received by the majority of the budget related to salaries is received by someone other than ourselves. So, and also too regarding like Bill's salary, there is a benchmark and it's taken to the board for review and just to make sure that everything was done correctly. If the scope was right, did we do it within the same region? And then they're the ones who approve whether higher level managers get a raise and what that amount should be. So normally, staff members that are part of the budget, we're not normally approving our own salary increases. We're approving the basically, in my case, I'm approving that the expenses are in line with GAAP and everything was calculated correctly. And because I'm just the receiver of information, Bill is not approving his own salaries. That has to go, anything that we approve in finance committee, all that has to go through another party, which is the board, to review, approve, and they could actually reject anything on the budget and bring it back to us with further comments and review. Did I explain that okay?
I think he did.
So is that still a conflict of interest, Brett?
So
If
this is where, because there's multiple layers, possibly not. So like if it was just one layer and like I'll keep it very simple, right? Like say the budget was approved by just the finance committee and the board was not very strong on oversight and they just like really relied on the finance committee. And let's say like you, Sylvia, and Sarah were members and there was one other member of the finance committee and you're approving the budget, that absolutely is a conflict, right? Like that is not good. But the fact that there's layers, that's kind of what's called a compensating control in place. It basically it's where like, okay, yeah, maybe you should have a conflict of interest, policy being signed if, like when something like everybody mentioned, right? Someone's a paid employee and they're part of a voting, member of a committee. But because there's multiple layers of oversight that's also being approved in like, budget, other, we can talk about finance, but it could be anything. That's where it's less of a risk, in my opinion. But it's still, again, if you want to do it, I wouldn't be opposed to it. But if you went the other way and said you didn't need it, I think you have the proper compensating controls in place to prevent any one or two or three people from making a decision that benefits them personally that wouldn't be caught by somebody else.
Yeah, I for myself, I look at the role of approving a budget just that we're fiscally responsible. I'm not the person that knows how to manage the publishing committee. I trust the leaders of that group to come forward with the budget, and I just ensure that we're able to absorb that spend with the current budget that it has been proposed for the organization.
Stop my share just so I could see everybody. If I need to share my screen again, I absolutely can, but everybody's just in a small window. I don't want to see everybody's faces. So, okay. So I have Josh, Sue, and Corbet. I don't know who wants to jump on the next question.
I can go. I think so, Brett, this may be something that part of what we're encountering right now, and there's been various conversations going on in multiple different committees and subcommittees about this phrase conflict of interest has been brought up in multiple venues. And I think it's important to understand that phrase means different things in different contexts. I think, for the purposes of the audit, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not the auditor, you are. It sort of has to do with, okay, do you guys have an annual conflict of interest, statement? Are people signing it? That kind of thing. And that generally, the kinds of conflict of interest statements, if I'm recalling correctly from the OPPM, mostly has to do with conflicts of interest. Like, but if like you were on another board or had a financial interest in something outside of WSO, that might cause you to make different decisions as part of WSO. I think what the things that people are bringing up here have more to do with maybe what I'd call internal conflicts of interest, like might, and so that's something. I don't know, is that you were sort of alluding to that you might be able to take a look further at that kind of thing. I'm not sure if that's normally part of a, audit or not. I honestly don't know. That's a big fat question mark for me. But I also feel like part of what people are getting at may get to sort of the thing that Corbet was talking about before. The there's auditing and then there's policy decisions that are made. And so some of this internal conflicts of interest, correct me if I'm wrong, may be more properly handled at the sort of examining the policy. But I mean, if you have recommendations, I think they'd be great to hear.
So like, this is where, again, my audit, I tailor my audit plan every year based on risk assessment. Like I mentioned, my auditor's report, I go through risk assessment. these are the high risks. What do I need to do to mitigate those risks so I can give my opinion? And I have to understand part of that is I have to understand internal control to understand how you work and how you operate in order to design my procedures to do what I need to do. And a huge part of that is what you're talking about, right? Like, even though I am doing a financial statement audit, I absolutely, it's imperative. I could understand how conflict of interest works, and I can tailor that to understand that in more detail to go, okay, let's pull, another layer off the onion here and go, how does this work at more of the employee level or at the subcommittee level where they're not board members, but they're, a decision maker, when it comes to publishing or whatever it may be. Like that's not historically what I've done, but I can tailor my audit plan for, because that's an internal control related piece, and I can have recommendations because a lot of my recommendations here, nothing to do really with the numbers. It's more, again, internal control. So when those things are in place, there's a better chance to your numbers being materially correct. Because again, I'm providing reasonable assurance, not absolute assurance, but the higher percentage of being correct is the better internal controls you have. And that's where why we're discussing this, right? So with conflict of interest, to keep it very simple, the way I like to describe conflict of interest is anybody who is part of ACA, whether an employee, board member, subcommittee member, volunteer, whatever you may be, everybody's best interest should be ACA. So, like when you're making a decision as a board member or budget, like, does ACA or are they the beneficiary of this? When there is a conflict in place, this is when it's like, oh, okay, like my brother is, part of, doing some construction thing that we're voting on, right? And it's my brother, right? Like I want to vote this piece in because they're my brother and I love my brother. Like that's conflict of interest, right? This is now ACA is not number one in this. Your brother might be number one in this. So that's a very extreme example, but that's where it comes, like on the what you mentioned of are you on a different board or are you have any financial interest? So financial interest, absolutely, that is the biggest one to me, right? Like if someone's benefiting, now nobody's ACA obviously is not a public company. Nobody, nothing's publicly traded, but like those bigger audit firms that are auditing the Apples and Microsoft, like they are very serious when it's like, hey, do you have any family members that own a portion of this stock? Because it is a big deal if they do. We don't have that issue. ACA is, there's no such thing as ACA stock to buy. But even like, when it comes to the, if they're a board member somewhere else, that's more of a time management thing. Like, I don't think that's an issue either, where if someone's on five different boards, they may not have the time to be on ACA. So that's even fine as well. But to keep things simple, just think everybody has the duty, obedience, and care. That's kind of the three phrases of board member to the nonprofit, right? Duty, obedience, loyalty, care. What is the number one priority of a board? That organization they're with. So as soon as something kind of takes their eye off that prize, that's a potential conflict that may need to be disclosed, or at least verbally, like, hey, I'm filling this form out. Do you guys think this is a conflict? And just have an open conversation, or at a minimum, just disclose it. I'm on a board where the program director is my sister-in-law. So even though she's not blood related to me, I see her pretty much once a week. She's been the program director for a while. She makes no financial decisions, but I still disclose it every year in my conflict of interest because I don't want it to come back and go, hey, wait a second here. The third in command of this nonprofit as the program director is your sister-in-law that you've known for 15 years. Like, what's going on here? So I just disclose it. And if I have to vote on compensation increases, I just abstain. It's like, hey, we're approving a 5% increase. We have 13 board members. I don't need to have a say in here. I'm just going to abstain from the vote. So those are the things that it's more of a every board member or committee member needs to have that mindset. And that's the most important thing. It's a culture thing. So then as a group and as a team, if there is any hint of a conflict, that should be kind of snuffed out and like, hey, look, what's going on here? And because and again, having that policy in place, talking about it annually, it just kind of keeps everybody in that right frame of mind of like, hey, like, yeah, let's we're a team here. ACA is the number one prize. Let's keep everybody on that, same, vision, if that's the right word. So
So,
Thanks, Brad. I have my hand up, but I don't know if you can see it.
I can see it now. Now that I've stopped sharing my screen, I can see like of much better with everybody.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for all the work that you've been doing these past couple of years. And thank you,
First.
Sylvia, for all the work that you've been doing.
Thank you.
I know you work so hard. And what I want to say is that this is a really good question. And it's a really good, thoughtful question to always keep top of mind. And it's something as I, as a board member and my fellow trustees, are always asking questions like this. Just to make sure that we're looking at everything. And we want to see facts, not necessarily opinions. Where are the facts? Where did you get the facts? And getting the facts from neutral third parties is very important. And that's why when we started looking at the executive compensation that you asked us to look at with the policy, we started looking at all of the positions. And we said, listen, we need an expert to tell us what is a fair market wage here. And so we spent the money and we did it. And the staff had nothing to do with it other than pulling together job descriptions and stuff like that. And so a lot of work has been done on the wages to make sure that we're benchmarking. We even went as far as to say, what would be a KPI for us to understand it when whether our payroll is sustainable? And that's in the report that we posted as well way back a year ago. And they said, I think it was around 60% of payroll, around 60, 65. And when we checked with the other 12 steps, we were in line with the other 12 steps. And so when it comes to the budget, the finance committee needs more volunteers. Pass the word on. They need more volunteers. It's not for not welcoming volunteers. It's a chronic issue we have in many of the 12 steps, and ACA is no exception. So we need more volunteers to come into the finance committee to support the staff that are there. However, they're recommending. They're not making decisions. And they will recommend something to the board. And I can tell you, and I see a couple of our board members here, Jim and Ken, I can tell you, and Sylvia would attest to it, we're constantly asking questions and pushing back and going back and forth when it comes to budget and money and everything else. So I just wanted to say that is that there are many, many eyes, and often we will say, so have we got a neutral third party opinion on this if it's necessary? So we're always asking the questions and not being afraid to hear the answers, and also not afraid to reach out and get the right support, such as the audit. We knew that we were getting close to the audit. Why wait? We hired. We went out and looked at three auditors and we picked you, Brett. And so I just wanted to say that is that these are great questions. Don't be afraid of them. Keep asking them because we do here. And let's keep doing this together, because all of the board members, and I would say all of our volunteers, are dedicated to ACA, and the staff work even beyond the hours that we pay them because they are so committed to this fellowship. With that, I'll pass. Thanks.
Hey, Sue. Kaz, did you have your hand up? I think it's down now.
Oh, yeah, Brett, thanks. Not a terrible issue, but it occurs to me that the most likely situation for a potential conflict of interest could come up because we have so many operations around the world now. You have a printing job that takes place in, I don't know, some island off the coast of Antarctica, and the penguins there have a really cheap printing press system set up. Well, is somebody recommending that because it's a really good printing company, or just because their brother-in-law happens to own and run it? So the issue when reaching out internationally is of greater concern to me. Because there's more opportunity, as we saw, some outfit got hold of our material and started printing it and selling it completely without authorization, and was basically stealing all of the income from it. And my suspicion personally is that there was something was going on with somebody in a printing company somewhere, slipping material to somebody else. My understanding is that investigating those kind of potential conflicts of interest is in the bailiwick of the general manager. And I would presume that our system is set up so that that is, in fact, covered. And if you have any recommendations in that regard on how we can better protect ourselves with people that we just can't possibly have close oversight over. I would love to hear them, but I'm not sure that there are any.
Yeah. One thing I've seen, I don't recommend this to many nonprofits, but it's something to think about, is because I don't want you to turn me off to vendors that you may want to work with. But I recall even myself signing some documents that says I don't have a conflict with anyone at that type of organization. So like, let's say I have a new vendor, like you said, Penguins in Antarctica, and it's a new vendor, you're not sure about them, you just have them sign something like, hey, yeah, I don't have, you don't say like brother-in-law, but you word it in a way where like they're supposed to identify on their end as well if they have, a financial interest or they know somebody at the organization. So you're kind of covering yourself in both ways. So like maybe you do something internally, outside looking in, and then outside, the other direction. But again, I don't want you to go like, starting the relationship off with the vendor going, hey, sign this. And they're going, hey, what is this? I've never had to sign this before. So not recommending you have to do it, but it's something I have seen and I've signed in the past. And I personally don't mind, but some others might. But it's a way to protect that if you're worried about someone's, brother-in-law benefiting, because you think they're the cheapest, in price, but it's just really someone that someone knows.
Thank you.
With that cause, all of the vendors that we use around the world have to sign an NDA. So we can go back and look at our NDA and see if there's a clause in regards to the conflict of interest. But the other thing I would say is it's very transparent. We go to the International Fellowship on the ground. They know who's reputable, who's not reputable, and we get different opinions from all of them. And we also go to the other 12-step world services and ask, who are you dealing with in these different countries? So that's so we've got resources.
Very good. Thank you.
And the goal too, like even if someone's brother-in-law happens to be, if they're the best person or company to do the job, you should go with them, but it still should be disclosed. Again, it comes down to culture, making sure that, when you stick that policy in front of everybody's face every year, it should train everyone to go, okay, this is something where I know this person. I should disclose this, because someone I know. Because if you do it just at the beginning of like a board term or like from an employee when they start, they've been there for 10 years, it may not kind of click in their head going, oh, I need to disclose this because it's something that they saw 8 years ago and it's just not on the top of their mind. But yeah, it really comes down to just culture more than anything. And I think you guys are doing a good job. But like you said, there is an international risk that I don't see for most of my clients. Most of my nonprofit clients are just in California. So it's much different than what you have to deal with.
Thank you.
Yeah, Josh.
I guess well, three things. One, just overall zooming way out from the entire, audit documentation, do you have any recommendations? Is first question. Like if are there, your maybe top two or three recommendations for the organization over the next year? That's one. Number two, definitely would be interested personally in, this talking about, looking at other kinds of conflicts of interest and internal controls and all that kind of stuff. I would definitely be interested in that. And then I guess part three is more maybe a comment for Sue is like, if we're getting into this whole thing about, different kinds of, I don't know, almost even relational conflicts of interest or something like, I don't know if that's, in these conversations about with other 12-step organizations, if there are any sort of like lessons learned or best practices for like, oh, we've run into a situation where we realized we had a kind of conflict of interest with, this person really should have been abstaining from a vote in this committee or any kind of thing like that. If there are any like, so we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Maybe other people already have some lessons learned for us. So there's a three-part thing.
I can definitely take the first one. And it's actually a good question because, leaving this kind of like when I talked about the management letter, it's like, okay, there's two recurring comments. They're both being resolved, right? The donor software and the allocation policy. And then, like, forget the exact numbers. Let's call it seven-ish got resolved, right? Awesome. This is a great, fun meeting to have. These meetings are fun when things get resolved. Now, one thing that I didn't mention, but I want to mention now because you're mentioning it, is don't get complacent about the things you corrected. Because I have had comments come back years later where it's like inventory count's a good example. It's like, oh yeah, we had two counters because the norm was one, you had a comment, we now have two, and it's more comfortable, right? It's easier to have one counter, that's doing inventory versus two. And then let's say I do the inventory count next year, we're back to one counter. Oops, we got the comment back on, right? On inventory count. I've seen that happen a lot. So when I ask recommendations of like things to do, don't lose kind of track of those ones that you've had resolve or that you resolve recently, because it's very human nature to kind of get back to the norm. You know, like if you've been doing one person inventory counts for 10 years and you just implemented a second counter for a year and that comment went away and now it's like, oh yeah, cool, comment's gone. Very easy to slip back into the old habits. So that's one thing I definitely want to mention. But otherwise, I really try to mention everything in those letters. Like, I don't have anything on top of my head that says do these two or three things. I would have said it in those letters. But I definitely want to mention, yeah, the prior comments, just keep those in the back of your head, because I've seen it happen many times. They will creep back up and it's like, yep, I talked about this 3 years ago. It's active again, right? Like we fell back into bad habits.
Thanks.
The second and third, I don't know if I can answer. I don't know if anybody else wants to jump in and answer those ones.
I can answer the third one. There was something about internal control, so I'll leave that one with you, Brett, to discuss. But relational conflicts, and can we learn from the other 12 steps? And that's what we are doing. So I'm listening right now to see is there something that we need to do a check-in with some of the other 12-step world services, because let's not reinvent the wheel and let's all learn together. And as soon as we got hit with the fraud, as an example, I posted a message to the other 12 steps and they said, beware, this is what's going on right now. And they were very thankful. Let's keep doing that. And I'll take this into consideration. Thanks.
Josh, can you repeat your second question again, real briefly, if?
Yeah, I guess it was more maybe not a request, or maybe a request. You were talking about, oh, you know, going forward, maybe I could look at some of these more other kinds of potential conflicts of interest that might affect, you know, maybe not financial internal controls, maybe, but maybe, you know. So I would just sort of like, I'd vote for that if I have a vote.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I do have a response to this. So I do inquiry questionnaires with kind of the key players. So like to the people on this call, Ken is audit committee chair, Sue is board chair, Sylvia as controller, Bill I don't think is on this call, general manager. But you know, five or six people, you know, even BPM, the outside accountants, like I interview them and my last question is always the same. Is there anything in particular you want me to look in this audit that kind of piques your interest, you want more information on? And that's kind of what you're kind of gearing at, right? It's like internal control, or, you know, when it comes to conflict of interest. So I give that question to those key players, but it doesn't open up to like you, for example, or for, you know, anybody else that even is not in this call that may be part of their mind. I tailor my audit plan early. So like when I do my risk assessment, I try to figure out what I'm going to do early on so I'm not over auditing, but I also don't want to under audit. So if you have those things in mind, maybe it's again something internally you do where you have some type of list where it's like, hey, these are the things that we want a third party like our auditor to look at. I can look at that list and try to tailor my audit plan to look at some of those things. So then when I'm reporting on this, similar to what I'm doing now for next year, I can say, hey, yeah, I looked at this because it was part of that list you gave me, you know, before the audit started. So if you can put that list, if you want to do something like that internally before December, January of next year, I can then incorporate that in, you know, whether it's more things than just conflict of interest kind of things like that we're talking about.
Thanks.
Actually, I have a hard cutoff at 3 o'clock my time. So that's 6 o'clock your time. I do have another meeting. So I know there's other hands, but I just want to kind of prioritize those if we can, if that's okay.
If you don't mind, I want to jump in because I want to invite Sue to mention, if she's still on the call. Yeah, to mention the formal dialogue that goes on amongst a good large number of the 12-step organizations.
So I think I mentioned that there's a 12-step world service organization network, and there's many 12 steps that are present as the executive director, usually two reps, executive director and chair of the board. And we actively share best practices, things that come up. A lot of stuff, because we're transparent, is posted on the websites and things like that, but some things may not be. And so there's a lot of day-to-day activity going on that we will connect with. For instance, so we had an opportunity to share a booth at the AA convention in Vancouver. I got an email from the Debtors Anonymous 12-step chair who I know and said, hey, what do you think? And I put him in contact with the general manager and then with the board, and the board approved that, hey, this would be a good thing. So that's one example. Another example is Debtor Anonymous is celebrating 50 years next year. And they want to do what we do in our AWC, our annual world convention. And I was able to share information with them as to how do we plan it, how do we run it, and et cetera. So that's just a couple of examples. And we meet once a year to collaborate on specific topics. So there'll be an agenda that will be done, and we'll be able to say, hey, we'd like this topic. But you usually can only do the first top three or four because there's just so much. So it's a rich network. It's recent in the last few years, and we need to keep it going. I think if that's what you wanted to know, Kaz.
Yes, ma'am. I wanted to advertise that as widely as we possibly can, because what an incredible value it is.
Yeah, and I'm fortunate because the Debtor Anonymous chair is in Canada. So we got to meet each other in person. We're about 45 minutes away. So that's unusual. And I think I want to come back to Brett because you said you're on a time crunch. So I don't want
to. Yeah, got about 5 minutes. And there's someone else with their hand up. Who was that? I don't know if they still have a question, but I just wanted to mention, I can probably push back the meeting a couple minutes, you know, if I'm late, but yeah, I don't want to be too late for that meeting. It's a finance committee meeting for one of the boards I'm on. So I just don't, I'm the chair of that meeting. If I wasn't the chair, I'd show up later, but yeah, I kind of run in the meeting. So
William has his hand up.
Yes, William.
I just wanted to thank you, Brett, for all that you've done. I think it's amazing work. And I wanted to say that you hit the nail on the head by pointing out that we tend to fall back into old behaviors, because as an adult child, I know that I like my familiar behaviors. And I tend to fall back into them frequently. Thanks.
Yeah. No, thanks, William. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, Brett. I put a question in the chat. Basically, it's about how a physical inventory count is done. Are there two people together?
They don't do together. They do it once. So like one person will do it. They then put on a piece of paper what the thing is. Actually, that's not true. They have their own, what do you call it, sheet in their hand. Mm-hmm. And then they relay that and put it on like a tag. And they might only do the tag for me because I asked for the tags for December. But then a second person does it later on. So they're not like counting together, because that's where groupthink comes in. We're like, oh, you counted 50? Oh, yeah, me too, right? No, it's not like that. They're done at separate times.
Thank you.
Okay, William, is your hand still up for something, or is it up from before?
It was up from before.
Okay, perfect. Ken?
Brett, thank you very much. And I know time is short. Certainly appreciate your input today and showing the value of being nitpicky. It was very, very helpful for our process. And one of the things I wanted to share with the group, one of the things we do is we critique ourselves of what's gone right and what can we do better or differently. And looking at the, you know, as Brett said, this is our second audit. First audit, we had a whole series of things happening and we rushed. Second audit, we had a whole things that happened and we slowed down. I think we've learned the value of critiquing and talking among ourselves, the audit team, the finance team, the board, of what we can do differently and how we can improve. And you know, one of the things I just wanted to share with the group is we were very fortunate in finding Brett, because he had close to 10 years experience working with us in various other roles as an accountant and a CPA with other firms and helping us in a couple of transitions. So that was, you know, that was very, very helpful, but we need to be aware of that as we look for auditors in the future in those things. But again, thank you very much. This has been a goldmine of information today. So thank you.
Oh, and anyone on this call is welcome to reach out separate. So like I'm gonna leave my email address, as just a comment here. Always happy to answer questions you may have, on the audit report or something comes up later on. So just let me know. But yeah, I do gotta hop off in about a minute. So thank you.
And thank you, Brett. And I think I'll mention as well is that we will be rotating in the future years different auditors, right? Because we want to have fresh.
Just one more year. Is that right, Ken, you're looking for?
Yes. Like, yep. One more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we're going to go after another recruitment for auditors to come in. And I think, Brett, that's best practice from what I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The sweet spot is anywhere from 3 to 7 years, in my opinion. A lot of nonprofits do not listen to that and they will stay with an auditor for 15, 20 years. I'm in the second year of my own firm. So I'm going to be a little more strict of like, hey, we got to kick these guys out. But it's a lot of groupthink in those big firms where it's like, oh yeah, they're a good client. They don't want to leave. We don't want to leave either. And that's where audit independence, kind of loses track a little bit because, you're with someone for 7+ years. Are you really independent anymore? It's hard. So, so 3 years is kind of the minimum. You're right at that. That's a good kind of spot to kind of leave if needed. So if you need any referrals, I know some other firms here in Long Beach, close to Signal Hills, just let me know if you need any referrals for that.
Please do.
Yeah, we would want to work with you forever, but we know we can't. We have to.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah,
put ACA first and keep rotating.
And I can always come back, right? If you want to rotate back into me after, we'll see how that goes. But yeah, I do got to run though. So thank you everybody for showing up. I'm glad there's lots of people. I've done these meetings. There's like three people. And it's like, oh man, like what are we going to talk about for 2 hours? And a lot of great questions. I appreciate that. But yeah, I got to hop off. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, man.
Take care.
Thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thank you, Ken, for hosting. And we can stop the recording. There you go.